This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, the Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about a subject that people think about and have to wrestle with all the time, but don't always take a moment to talk about, and that is taste. And today we are in for a real treat because we're going to be looking at really the fundamentals of taste in some way, the philosophy of taste. And I'm really pleased to have my guest, Professor Robert Valgenti, who is a professor of philosophy, in fact, at Lebanon Valley College, here with us in the studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, well, thank you for having me here. This is great.
This will be great, and I know it'll be great because we've had many conversations about the philosophy of taste. And I was thinking this morning, we're going to jump right in, because I was reading in the Times this morning a profile of a chef who's a friend of mine and who has been on the show, Andrew Carmelini, and who I think, underlying that profile of how he was a chef and how he wasn't out there to create an empire of media presence and television shows and all these sorts of things, was also underlying that conversation the idea that he wasn't an artist but actually a cook, and that food was really important to him. And this question of food and art, which comes up all the time, we use it, we throw it around. There's the magazine Food Arts, there's the idea that chefs are artists these days and they ought to be given the attention of artists and they ought to be doing things in museums and all that sort of stuff. And since we've had these conversations, and I know this is something you think a lot about, I'm really excited to have you on the show. And to just start there, what's our obsession with food and as art, and is it, and do we care, and is it even important or relevant?
Yeah, I think, once again, thanks for having me here, and maybe to pull apart all those, those issues that are in there. Start with the easy one, right?
Yes.
With the question of what art is, and then maybe, which is not the easy one at all, but ask what art is and what it means for food to be considered art, and then to really talk about why that matters or doesn't matter.
Sure.
Or what that says about us. So the question of what art is, we're always thinking about, in a sense, human productions, works of human creation that aren't always art. There are many things that we do, many techniques that we employ, and this maybe ties into the idea of being a chef who employs certain techniques or a certain type of craft, but not necessarily is an artist in some way, that we do these things all the time. We make things. We think a lot, but it's not necessarily always philosophy. We create things, but it's not always art.
Right.
We speak. It's not always poetry.
Speak for yourself. Everything I say.
I'm trying, but it's difficult. But in those distinctions, we might ask, well, what is it that separates the two? And why is that separation important? And what does that separation say about us as a culture, as a society? Mm-hmm. And I always think that if we want to put our finger on what identifies art as something singular, it might be that what it does for us is that it exposes a certain type of way that we as a society or a culture order our sensible perceptions. And art goes farther than just highlighting that order or enacting that order, but it also exposes the conditions behind it, what allows it to be, and potentially threatens to undermine those conditions as well. So art, for me anyway, is always something that has the potential to be radical in the true sense of that word, getting to the roots of things, exposing the conditions for its possibility, and then threatening to maybe overturn them. And so this is how we say that art challenges us in a way. But always on the one side of that challenge, there's going to be the opposing side that is the entrenched system, the system that's in place. And so the question, what is art, is always a controversial question, because it in one sense highlights the powers that be. Mm-hmm. But it also points to those who would wish to redistribute that power in some way. And so that's why it's always an interesting question and a question we should keep open, particularly in a democratic society.
And so, you said a lot already in the first 3 minutes of the show. That's why I love doing the show and why I love Heritage Radio, because it's one of the few places we can have a conversation like this. The sensible perceptions, let's start there. So we're talking some sort of interaction that we feel through the senses in some way. And so it's us in the world sort of processing the exterior world, beyond philosophy almost, like this is very sensory.
Yeah, well, and that's always, I mean, a challenge for philosophy in the first place is to get outside of its head, if you will. But philosophy begins there. Philosophy begins not with someone off in a corner thinking by themselves. It begins in the public square with the ancient Greeks in dialogue. Mm-hmm. So we look at those great works by Plato, the Socratic dialogues, and this is a place where there's conversation. And so it's always important to get outside of one's thoughts, and the real danger is that our thoughts become completely detached from our senses. So when we think of the beginning of this question, what is art, we want to be careful not to think that it's only about our sense perceptions. Mm-hmm. For us as human beings, it's never simply that, as much as we would like to throw ourselves sometimes into, you know, these hedonistic moments of sensory enjoyment. It's always also about our heads. Mm-hmm. And those two things are there. So when we think of aesthetics as the branch of philosophy that looks at what is a work of art and what is something that is beautiful, it's always about how our sensory perceptions and our sensory experiences are framed within this very human way of encountering the world that involves our minds and our understandings. And to the degree to which our understanding and the shape of our brains, even, if you will, affect the sensory perceptions that we have. And so exposing that framework, coming to understand that framework, is maybe one of the first tasks of aesthetic experience. What does it mean to think of those sensory perceptions in a particular way? And it's odd for philosophy at this point to start thinking about food, because food has for its entire history really been set aside as a philosophical concern, because it is so tied to the body. And so when you look at aesthetics as a philosophical branch, what you find is that philosophers are interested in the types of arts that deal with sound and deal with sight, because they're a lot cleaner and more objective. You can hold them at a distance, and makes it somewhat easier, if you will, and cleaner, as compared to food, which of course you have to ingest and becomes you. You can't observe it objectively. It actually gets appropriated into your body.
Right. And so you don't sense the taste of something until it's in your mouth. You can see it, you can hear it, but that proximity, I guess, is clouds things a little bit, or historically anyway, in philosophy.
Yeah, historically. And so a lot of the reason why I think it's interesting to return to this question of why food is important for philosophy is precisely so one can shake up not just the realm of the arts, but also to shake up a little bit the realm of philosophy, which has benefited from the same kind of, as Carolyn Kurzmeier will call it, the hierarchy of the senses. And so if we can think about undermining that hierarchy, reordering that hierarchy, for me as a philosopher, the question is always not just why is food an interesting object in terms of its aesthetic qualities, but how does it help me think differently and maybe better as a philosopher?
So still 45 things said in there that we could digress on.
More complex rather than
it's good, and this just means we'll have you back is what it means. I think let's just explain a little. Let's look a little bit at the involvement of the brain and in eating, because I think it's something we often confuse when people are talking about taste. And you know, there are four tastes, or there are five tastes, or maybe there are 10 tastes, and we think about them in a very biological and chemical sense. You know, we have receptors and things go on our tongue and we eat them, and sometimes they relate to what's in, I mean, they directly relate to what's in the things we're consuming. But it's this process of putting the brain in it, I think, that's really where gastronomy comes. I mean, Priscilla Parkes Ferguson has looked at all this sort of work, and that's where the French cuisine arrives, this idea of cuisine that isn't just food we eat or for nourishment, but is something else. So part of that combination, I think, is really important to highlight here, that we're not just talking about molecules on our tongue, we're talking about something in our head.
Right. So if we, going back to a phrase I used earlier, I talked about good art being something that shakes up and exposes those conditions of possibility. This is what we might say is always already in place, and opens up our world or our horizon of experience. And so when I, you know, am having this conversation with you, it's not just me as an individual across the room from you as the person interviewing me. I'm bringing my language, my experience, all of this history to bear on this, along with all these other physical aspects I don't have so much control over, the sound of my voice, my body, and all these things. So when we think of the experience, you know, the gastronomic experience, if you will, what I think the branch of aesthetics helps us to do, the philosophical branch of aesthetics helps us to do, is to ask the question, well, what makes that experience possible? And so we have all of the physiological aspects of our bodies. We know that, you know, taste is in great part a chemical reaction that's occurring in our bodies. We know that the experience of eating different types of foods from the moment it enters our mouth to the time it passes through our body has all sorts of physiological connections that we can't have immediate control over. But we know that eating is much more than that. And so this is the other aspect, I think, of art that is important, that art to a certain degree entails a kind of transcendence. And I don't mean this in any sort of otherworldly sense, but it's always pointing towards our possibilities of what we are and what we can become. And so what gets brought to bear on that physiology is also my history with those foods, my cultural awareness, my historical sense as a being, and the historical sense of those around me. So we know foods that are forbidden, foods that are well accepted, foods that we find comforting. These all become part of that experience as well. And we know that, and this is from the angle of philosophy that concerns me, these things are never absolute or set in stone, that these things are constantly in flux. And so trying to gain one's bearings, trying to expose those conditions of possibility, is always a work in progress. And it's why the questions always keep unfolding, and why there's a kind of need for dialogue.
And I would imagine that's also where the concept of power comes in, this that in the interpretation, the flux, the ability either to manipulate or to just embed systems and structures and hierarchies of what, if anything, status, class, money, power, in the biggest sense.
The experience is one of the things I try to show my students, is that the experience of eating today is and whether we want to think of it in an artistic sense or just in an average everyday sense, is really quite mind-boggling in the sense that on the one end, we're more connected to more individuals and more structures of power than we ever have been before. So if I eat a hamburger at a fast food restaurant, I am immediately now in contact with distributions of labor power, distributions of goods and services that are global. The number of connections are, you know, seemingly infinite, we might say. And so to one extent, I'm more connected to more people than ever before. And more systems of power than ever before. But the degree of those connections is smaller and smaller the more those connections become. And so here's where I try to argue the ethical question arises out of the aesthetic one. Mm-hmm. So in that aesthetic experience of eating that food, whether it's you know, the highest cuisine or it's just a fast food hamburger or something in between, that experience of eating the food brings together my horizon of experience and the horizons of experience of everyone involved in the production of that food. Mm-hmm. But because those degrees of connection are so small, I might overlook them, I might miss them, I might not care about them. So as anyone in food studies, you know, has come to realize, knowing what it means for food to exist on our plate today means understanding all of those systems of distribution, of power, of nutrition on down the line and the way that they affect us. And if we can, as I said before, bring to light those conditions of possibility, understand how that event of that piece of food in front of us comes to be, we might be more concerned not just about the fact that it exists, but about how it has come into being and what kinds of choices were made there. Because the smaller those connections become, the more likely we are also to think that they're beyond our control and that we don't have much to do with them, or they're just natural and they just happen that way. So how do we reinvigorate the element of individual responsibility and choice, understanding full well that the impact of our choices will be as minuscule as the impact of all of those little pieces along that chain in that way. So the element of collective responsibility becomes really central here, but really difficult to sell because it's those singular impacts are so small.
And we'll leave you to contemplate those singular impacts and the minuscule connections of whatever it is that you're eating right now while we take a quick break. You're listening to Taste Matters on Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Forever by Jerome Lowell on heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Chris Howell from Cain Vineyard and Winery. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cain encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. For more information, visit cain5.com.
You're back listening to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. And we are talking with Professor Bob Valgenti, who's a professor of philosophy, I should say, at Lebanon Valley College, about some really important, perhaps abstract, but significant and profound things about food underlying so much of what I think is going on in the conversation about food in certain circles here, without understanding necessarily some of the really profound underpinnings of what food means, of what these judgments we make means, of what eating a hamburger or eating a 26-course gastronomic event in a very particular sense of the term might portend. I want to ask you, just to leap ahead to one of my earlier points of my question, and why do you think we're obsessed with making food art or claiming it as art? And does that have something to do with perhaps the banality of just eating and that proximity? Or what do you think is to be gained, if anything?
Yeah, there's probably a great deal of psychological responses, social psychological responses that could be given to that question that I'm completely unqualified to provide here. From a philosophical stance, I think what's interesting about the way the chef and the celebrity chef has come into the idea of that chef has come into its own in our current society. We know that we value expertise and we value excellence in certain ways. And so I think to a great degree, it speaks to our tendency as human beings to place things into hierarchies and to order them in certain ways. And we can explain this culturally and economically and varying degrees. From the philosophical perspective, I think what is what should be of particular interest is the question, by what criteria or by what standards are we going to distinguish this very singular thing as a work of art? Mm-hmm. So when I talk about the gastronomic event, mm-hmm. or I talk about the experience of eating as a kind of event, this is something that has its lineage in the philosophy of Martin Heidegger and the way that he privileges art, because it allows him to make a philosophical point perhaps better than any other form of human activity. So he looks to language and he looks to the arts as a way of talking about the event, or the German word Ereignis, as something that comes into its own in a singular way and in a sense creates its own standards for existence. So it's incommensurable with anything else. It can't be compared. And so if we think about the gastronomic event as something that's singular, the purpose in that singularity is to undermine traditionally what have been the kind of nodal points of aesthetics: the work of art, the spectator, mm-hmm. and then of course the artist. And there's a special place that we have, especially, you know, post-romantic age, mm-hmm. for the artist as the great genius and as the great creator. And going back to the point you brought up earlier about the chef who just wants to say, I'm just employing these techniques, I'm not an artist, this is not high art in that way, there's a sense in that where I would say the great artist is one who doesn't just impose his or her own will on the material, whether it's a steak or it's a block of marble or a canvas or whatever it might be, but that the great artist is always an interpreter, is someone who is able to not only shape, but to reciprocally be shaped by the material. Anyone who's a musician knows that when you sit down in front of a particular drum, or you take up a particular guitar or other instrument, that very instrument and its particular qualities oftentimes influences what you feel compelled to play at that moment, or the way that you will play it. And I think in the experience of food and cuisine, particularly I think of when I try to experiment with ingredients or recipes that are unfamiliar to me, I am immediately brought before myself as someone who can no longer just simply impose his will upon the ingredients, but has to be very sensitive to this new thing in front of me. And it's at that point where I would say, when we think of art as or exposing those underlying conditions, it's at that moment that I realize how have I been cooking all along, and now what do I need to do differently? And that's not a bad lesson to transfer into our day-to-day interactions with people. This is why I think there's a strong ethical element that's here, is if I can understand through an experience of eating, whether I'm making the new cuisine or I'm just encountering a new cultural cuisine that I've never tried, it's going to shake up my presuppositions and perhaps make me more mindful of the choices. And the great thing about food, and so why is food particular in this instance? What we know from studies of diplomacy and what we know from maybe just our personal experience is that food takes the edge off. If we sit down around a table and we break bread, we're less likely to be hostile and confrontational, maybe even more willing to bring ourselves into question. And that's always, I think, primary to the philosopher, is to turn that mirror towards oneself and be reflective.
It's funny because just today at the State Department, the American Chef Corps and the Diplomatic Culinary Partnership that the James Beard Foundation has with the United States Department of State is having a meeting about the diplomacy of gastronomy in some ways. So there you go. They're recognizing it full on.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful strategy. Right. I mean, to think of it in that way, but hopefully it's more than just strategy.
Right.
It's also... you know, if we could distinguish strategy from good diplomacy, that we should want to break bread mm-hmm. with our fellow human beings around the planet. That should be the nature of our encounters.
I'm so glad you brought the conversation back to ethics, because unexpectedly, I guess, you've been talking about a mindfulness, a philosophical mindfulness, an opening up, an understanding of the connections that come together in food and sort of in gastronomy. I think that's an issue that's risen to into the conversation about food and taste and gastronomy in a way that it hadn't before. I mean, over the last 30 years in our country, or 40, you know, since Alice Waters maybe, and even before, but that this question that, or this idea that eating is ethical, that there's an ethics of eating that we need to, that might even impact the taste and the pleasure one enjoys. And I'm wondering if you could just expand on it a little bit more, because Heritage Radio Network is an organization based on trying to make people more mindful of the food they eat. And those things aren't always aligned with the value placed on certain tastes. I'm thinking of particular ingredients and how they're produced and ways. I just think we're in a moment of flux about that, about how to put the two together.
And it might be to, as I'm always wont to do as a philosopher, to go back to the origin that, in philosophy, we think of the different branches: aesthetics that deals with art, ethics that deals with human choices, ontology that deals with questions of existence, et cetera, and so on. And those divisions, we oftentimes think, oh, these must be natural divisions. Mm. And I would argue that, no, those are separations or abstractions after the fact, and that these things are held together. And this is why I think food is such a great topic for philosophy, because what I can show through food oftentimes is that the ethical question, the aesthetic question of beauty, the existential question of how does this exist and why does it exist, and even the epistemological question of what does it mean to know this thing or to know this as an object of food, that those are all kind of contained within that experience of eating. You can find them all there. And I think what the experience of food also shows us, and this is the problem that you seem to be expressing here, is that they're not easily separated out. We would like to have multiple courses. First, we'll deal with the ethical question. Then we'll deal with the aesthetic question. But the reality is our pleasure is never divorced from our choices. Maybe that's a tough pill to swallow. But I always, when I think of initiatives that I'm going to be starting at the college where I work, where we're going to be talking about sustainability, ethics, and cultural diversity through mm-hmm. food, and implementing programs with our culinary service at the college. The real problem is always, when you start talking about ethics and food, you take the fun out of eating. You take the joy out of eating many times. And it doesn't always match up that the thing that brings you the most pleasure is going to be the thing that's going to be the most ethical choice.
Right.
I mean, one side of me wants to say, yeah, get over it, tough.
Right.
But the other side, is that all matters of taste and all matters of ethical choice to a certain degree are not natural, are not set in stone, right, are not absolute. And so if there's a modicum of choice that's there, realize that even though it seems absolute to you because it's your taste, that taste has been developed over time, and that taste can be reformed. And so just because you think this is the best tasting thing right now and you don't care how unethical it is, what you have to let go of is not the ethical choice at that moment, but you need to investigate, why do I have these tastes in the first place? Mm. And to what degree have they been out of my control? And what would it mean to put them to some degree, not completely, but to some degree in my control? Mm. And this connects it to when people ask me, well, what is philosophy? Maybe some of the listeners today are like, well, hold on a second. Everyone has an idea of what it is. And in one sense, it's the clarification of concepts through the use of reason. Okay, everyone can now go to sleep. There's another sense in which it is the type of thinking that brings us to a state of wonderment, this idea that we get from Socrates and Plato's Theaetetus. And this is a good idea because it shows us how our childhood selves are really the model for what it means to be a good philosopher, to take wonder at the very things around us, to not be jaded. Mm. But I would push that even farther, and I would say that very simply what philosophy is thought that liberates. And so if a certain way of thinking, a certain critical approach to the way that we eat, engaging our brains as we eat, lights up those conditions of possibility, shows us where those power structures are, and shows us the degree of our choices and where our choices are possible. If we can do all of those things, I think we're freer than if we're just victims of habit, which is so often the way that all of us, including myself, eat. Mm-hmm. And so if we're able to do those things and just shed some light on the playing field and see what's going on, at least there's a possibility of being freer as agents rather than being more controlled by either the forces around us or the forces of habit that are in us. And doesn't mean that we'll do it, but...
And therein, ladies and gentlemen, lies the reason that taste matters. Thank you, Bob, for being here. Such a fascinating conversation. I hope that we'll continue it. I realize I didn't encourage people to call in, but if you're listening to the podcast or you are listening to the archive, you can ask questions at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or you can also tweet us questions, only 140 character questions, at Taste Matters HRN. Thank you so much for being here. It's a real pleasure always to have a conversation with you that leads to wonderment, as desired. Next week, we'll be talking to Paul Friedman, who will keep the conversation very heady, a professor of history at Yale University with a particular interest in the sort of history of restaurants and menus in New York City and in the United States. In the meantime, before then, eat something and think about it, please.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.